The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on January 18, 2026. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Nice to see you all here. I know it's kind of crazy. Writing this talk, I originally wrote, I don't think I'm partisan, but I think I'd rather say, I hope I don't sound too partisan when I say that. At least to me right now, it feels like the city is under siege. Right? And, I've heard from friends who are far asking how things are going, and certainly talking to people in town, people who this directly affects, and it really kind of impacts all of us, thinking about the feelings that are expressed, the fear that some have for their kids, the anger that they might feel, the despondency, the exhaustion. I don't know, I could go on and on, and maybe you feel all of that, and maybe you don't feel any of it, but when circumstances like this show up, when events show up like this, there is a tendency to turn towards something like these teachings, right, to kind of help us understand what's going on and perhaps what it is that we can do. And I think that's only natural, especially with this practice, oddly enough, because of some of the things that I'm going to say about it. But I think it's natural because we're getting a sense, as it feels like this is too much perhaps, that this is where our practice really takes place. Right? And that is the title of my talk, which is Where Practice Takes Place. But it really comes to life to us that this is where our practice takes place when, right, like I said, it becomes clear to us when it seems like right now we can't take a step forward, right? When it feels like you can't go on. For whatever reason, maybe you don't know how to go on. Maybe you feel too exhausted, or you're just so convoluted. It's like that sentence, first you feel like you can't go on, but then you do, right? So it's like that sentence from Samuel Beckett novel, The Unnameable. It's actually just part of the sentence. I learned AI has now corrected what I always thought the sentence of this book was. I read the book. Very, very interesting and incredibly difficult book to read. But the sentence is, I can't go on, I'll go on. I can't go on, I'll go on. Right? When we get there, when we're at this point where we go, how do I do this? How come this is happening? How come this is happening right here? What am I supposed to do about it? And at those moments, we sense, we feel, this is where practice takes place, right here in these moments. Dana Katagiri had a teaching, Stephen Norm's teacher. And he said, you don't really practice patience until you don't have any, right? And it makes sense. If you think about it, if everything's going your way, and it's just smooth sailing, you don't really have to practice patience, do you? I mean, it's just going your way. But when things stop going your way, right, when it looks like everything's against you, then at that moment, that's when perhaps patience might be needed, right? So to practice this is to realize that here we are. Here we are in those moments when it feels like it's all against us, right? When it feels like everything is at odds with us. Here we are. And again, that's why we might turn to these teachings. It's just we can sense This is where it really matters. It matters in every moment, but it's when things aren't going our way that we sense that this is where practice is. We sense that. So we turn to the teachings. We turn to this practice. That it's not somewhere else that we're going to do this. It's not some other time that we're going to do this. It's now. And right now may not look so promising to us, right? It might seem to us that, and I've had Hamlet on my mind for a while. I went to see that movie Hamnet, which is kind of like a fictional biopic about the writing of Hamlet. And so I've just been thinking, it's a great play. You know, I mean, I'm not going out on a limb on that one, but it's a great play. And Hamlet, you know, his description, we might feel like Hamlet when he says that the time is out of joint. The time is out of joint. And instinctively, we know it's time to get serious, right? So we might turn to this practice. We might turn to these teachings. And there's something about these teachings in particular that's interesting because, at least I think it's interesting, because they're not going to, like, give us something to tell us what to do, right? That's not what they do. They're not going to give us specific instructions about, well, in this situation, in case of emergency, you know, and then give you like a series of instructions. And this is what I think a lot of religious teachings do, is they give you a very specific instruction, very specific teaching, and then they go ahead now and apply it in every aspect of your life, you know. And Buddhism gives us these universal teachings, right, that are teachings about, well, they're really just bringing us back to what's going on here, right? And then those teachings resonate with specificity. So rather than being a specific teaching that we apply to everything, it's a universal teaching that has resonance in every moment if we're paying attention. But it doesn't give us those instructions. It doesn't tell us what is the right thing to do. Instead, what it does is it directs our attention back to what's really going on. And I'm going to talk about that in a second. What's really going on, it directs us back to what's really going on so that we can stop worrying about what's the right thing to do. Right? Because that's where we get caught up. What's the right thing to do? Here it is. It feels like, you know, what is the right thing to do? Bring your attention back. See what's really going on. And that urge to know what's the right thing to do, it's not so insistent. It's not so urgent to us. What's really going on, we should know, is not what we think. Unless what's really going on is we realize that thinking is what's going on, right? Then it's what we think. But even then, this is important too, our practice is to see reality, see what's really going on. To see, and Suzuki's got a phrase for this, Shinryu Suzuki, what's really going on. He calls it things as it is. Things as it is, which is an interesting way to put it. Because we might say, well, in fact, somebody, I think they did, they said, well, Suzuki, it's in English, it's things as they are, not things as it is. And he said, no, I mean things as it is. Because that has built into it the fact that what our teaching, what's really going on, isn't what we think is going on, right? It's not how things are, which is the way we usually think, right? So things as they are, but really it's things as it is, and things as it is seeing how things have come to be. That is our teaching, to come back to what's really going on. What's really going on is how to see how things have come to be. And how it has come to be, how these things have come to be, it's not what we think. So when we hear that, we might go, oh yeah, well, I just put some analysis to it. And the reason why things are happening right now is because, and then we can make these connections. And I was just talking with a student recently about this, who was talking about, I think they were kind of just sort of tracing through how a particular event happened, and they were just startled by how they could do that. And I said, well, yeah, I had a friend who could do that. He could tell you these amazing stories, and they sounded very mystical, actually. He could go through these incredible stories to explain why he was doing exactly what he was doing right now. And these things had like cosmics, you know, I mean, it was amazing. What it would make the hair stand up in my arms listening to him, because I was like, oh my God. And then I realized you could do that with anything. You could take any starting point and make it the craziest starting point. And then you can actually start putting together a story showing how that starting point led exactly to what's going on right now. You know, it's something we do, and that's not seeing how things have come to be. That's just stories we're telling, and we're pretty good at it. And sometimes those stories or those interpretations, right? Sometimes they can be kind of helpful. I'm actually going to look at, I'll call it a provisional teaching that's kind of helpful, you know, that I'm not going to claim is the truth, but that's going to kind of steer us back toward seeing things as they have come to be rather than how they are, the way that we normally think. So things as they have come to be is not necessarily our analysis of how things have come to be, even though that can be helpful to help us understand stuff. It can be helpful to explain it, to tell stories about it, but of provisional use. The stories are only helpful until they're not really helpful. And then maybe somebody else comes up with another story, and perhaps it sheds light on the old story we used to tell ourselves, or perhaps it comes up with a completely new one, a new way of understanding, of interpreting, of analyzing the situation. Right? This is how, you know, knowledge, our usual way of knowledge, right? Our fact-based knowledge. This is how it's based. We get some data points, kind of make an idea, come up with a theory or whatever. We test it out. It's a scientific method, but I encountered it when I was in literature as well. You know, we were studying literary analysis, and there'd be ways of reading, modes of reading, right, that seemed to make a lot of sense. You'd be like, oh, that's synergy. It'd be very insightful until it stopped being insightful. Until it started to just be what everybody did when they talked about literature. And then what doors it was opening up, it was just slamming them left and right, right? Then it became like another, I don't know, set of rules that you had to follow. And then somebody would come along and they'd just sweep all that stuff aside and they'd come up with a new way to do it, right? And new doors would open up, new ways of thinking. But that's not what we're talking about here. Things as it is, isn't these explanations. Because how this has come to be, it's beyond our comprehension. It's beyond our comprehension. We have a chant. I think I've mentioned this at other talks, but it's really a great teaching. It's a chant that we do before we have a meal at our sessions and our meditation retreats. And it starts out, innumerable labors have brought us this food, we should know how it comes to us. And I remember when I first heard it, other than the fact that I thought the wording was goofy, I still remember that. It was like, innumerable labors have brought us, you know, it just wasn't rolling off my tongue. But that didn't matter, because what it seemed to be saying was, pause, you know, here we are getting this food. And do you think about that? Innumerable labors have brought us this food. And so then I just started thinking about innumerable labors, right? So then you just start thinking about, I don't know, growing crops and people shipping it to stores and people working at, you know, and I'm thinking about all the work that went into it. And once you start doing that, if you really are doing this in earnest, once you start doing that, it just keeps opening up. It's like you're unpacking. You've got this things, you know, the way they are, the way that we usually interpret what's taking place. things as they are. And then you start unpacking it. And the more you unpack, you realize it's, I suppose it's like those magician that's got the cloth that goes in the sleeve and just goes on and on and on. You just keep unpacking because you think you know what the innumerable labors are. But if you're actually paying attention to the wording there, it's saying innumerable labors. So good luck getting to the bottom of that, right? It'll take you forever. That's innumerable. That's what we're talking about. Like what is showing up here, how this has come to be, is beyond our comprehension. It's innumerable labors have brought about this situation, right? That's what our teaching helps us bring our attention back to. Right? This practice is deep focus. Right? It's deep focus. It's single-pointed focus is one way that we talk about it. But that single-pointed focus isn't to look at a particular thing and kind of get in there. Single focus is the whole picture. That's single focus. The other way is very fragment. You pull that up and then you're missing out on that. Look at that and then you're missing that. Right? Shinryu Suzuki said that, you know, when he's watching his students practicing, because if I look at those of you who are kind of sleeping over there, I'm going to miss that they're doing the same thing over here, right? You direct your attention on one thing, you're missing something else. This is the nature of when we pick things up. This is the nature of when we think that what's showing up is what it is, right? This is the way that we packaged it. We're blocking out, we're pulling this thing up and we're blocking out the whole picture. So this practice is deep focus. We see particularities. You can't help but see particularities. That's how this is showing up. To not see the particularities is not to see the whole picture. I don't even know how you could do that, to be honest. I don't know if my eyes are bad enough right now. They're starting to get that way. You remove some of the particularities and you take your glasses off. But that's not what we're talking about. It's about not getting caught with the particularities, not grabbing hold of a particular thing, right? Instead, seeing the particularities for what they are, which is innumerable labors have brought us this. It's to be aware of that. It's to see that. So that when you have a particular situation, like what's going on right now in Minneapolis, in Minnesota, where we get stuck right there at what's happening, if we can actually have that deeper focus, look at the bigger picture, then we can start to see, you know, that this isn't just this, it's the innumerable labors that have brought this to be. There's more to it than just what we might immediately focus our attention on. Right? And again, we encounter this all the time in life, where we encounter something, we've got it nailed down, and we're not seeing the whole picture. It just happens all the time. You know, I've told this story before, but it's one of my great embarrassments, you know, being caught behind a car at a light at my community college, you know, and I'm running a little late. I teach, and I didn't get out of the house as early as I would have liked to, and I had to do something to prepare for a class. And you know, I'm behind this car, young men, and they're stopped at a red arrow, and the arrow light indicates when you could turn into the college parking lot. It's on a busy street, and they're not turning when the light turns green. And you know, it's a car full of young men, and I'm going, just not paying attention. I'll give them a couple seconds here. You give them a couple seconds, and they don't turn. So then I just honk the horn. It's all just a polite little Minnesota honk, you know, honk. And they still don't move. And I'm going, ah. So then I honk a bit more insistently. And they still don't move. So then I honk a bit more insistently because I got to go, you know. I'm running behind schedule. And one of the guys in the back turns around and he looks at me and I point up at the arrow. And I just stay there. And I'm like, honk, I honk again. And the guy turns around, he kind of does a shoulder shrug thing, and he goes, They're going to wait until the absolute last minute, and then they're going to turn, and I'm going to get stuck at the red light just to take revenge on my honking my horn at them. That's what they're doing here. And, of course, just as that thought had gone through my mind, then the ambulance that was coming down the road that they could see went past, right? That kind of thing, where you think you know the situation, and you don't see the whole picture because you're looking at just what's in front of you, and you start to interpret that, right? Same thing with Minneapolis. What's going on right now in Minneapolis, in Minnesota, right? We get stuck with the particularity of what's going on, and we miss the conditions that brought it about. And one thing we can see, if we really have the deep focus, and this isn't much of an insight, but we can really see it, is that what's showing up, you know, as this stuff is dukkha. It is this profound, you know, unrest, uneasiness of mind. And it's not, the thing about this insight is that that's not unique to Minneapolis or Minnesota right now, right? That dukkha is showing up. This is just becoming clear to us because time is out of joint. So we can taste it a little bit more easily. So as I was preparing this talk, I looked at my iPhone probably 1,000 times. It's not like I just looked at it. When I looked at it, you know, I have Apple News. Apple News is trying to get me to subscribe to it. So they're kind of tossing me some delicious little tidbits here. And this one said, "The deadliest addiction." That was the headline that had "the deadliest addiction." And then there was like a little subphrase under it said, "And it's not drugs." and we all know what that is, right? What's going on there, right? It's how electronic media like instills dukkha in us. So you go, what is this deadliest addiction? Do you know what I mean? And now you've got the little itch, and it's like, we know it's, they call it clickbait, right? So you go, what is the death? If it's not drugs, what could this possibly be? And then you want to click on it and get the pleasure. And there's more dukkha there, right? Going for that pleasure. And then the pleasure, once you get there, then you go, that's it. You know, I just clicked on it for that. So what I have tended to do now is I do look at what the source is. If I'm curious, and I was curious about this, and I was like, okay, I'm game, but I am not going to click on that. I'm not going to, because that's what they want me to do. So I'm not going to click on that. So what is this from? Oh, it's from Slate Magazine. Well, that's not too bad. That's not like, you know, Popular Mechanics or something. So I go online, and I just type deadliest addiction. I might have even put not drugs or whatever, and boom. What the article is about pops up for me. In fact, eventually I just get to Slate without going through Apple News. So am I still engaging in the behavior that the internet wants me to? Yes, I am. Yes, I am. There's dukkha showing up and I'm still like, oh, I gotta know. And this is something we can see. I was curious. And what's interesting is that it was, because it seems so pertinent, and I have a feeling that's why the article was recirculating. It's something that came out last summer, actually. It was talking about revenge addiction. So now here I'm going to tell you about an analysis, an interpretation of the world. So I'm not trying to argue that what I'm going to tell you now is true, but this is just a conversation people are having, and they're having it because of observations they made, right? And I think we can see in it, if we look past with our deeper focus and see what it is that the article's talking about. But revenge addiction, I hadn't even really heard of that before. So what this article was a summation of studies done by neuroscientists about what our brain is doing when we engage in fantasies of revenge and even acting on revenge. So what neuroscientists had discovered through brain imaging is that when we feel aggrieved, Right? When we feel that the world has been putting stuff on us, it's been causing us some pain, and maybe we can point right to the source of, you are making me feel like, you know, it's just the way I was doing that, it reminds me of one of the great shows of dukkha. You know, most popular culture can get right into the dukkha part, but they never really see beyond that. But The Honeymooners, if you ever watched The Honeymooners, you know, Jackie Gleason, great comedian, and his character, Ralph Cramden, the whole world was always bullying up on Ralph, and Ralph was, you know, he could point right at the sources of his aggravation. And of course, if we're watching, we can see everything made him like that, or actually you start to realize nothing really made him like that. That was just how we responded all the time. And so according to this, when we feel that way, when we feel aggrieved, then according to brain imaging, you know, our pain network is activated. So there's parts of our brain that experience pain. And then when our pain network is activated, our typical response is to want pleasure. And so if you think about the clickbait experience, it's kind of like that, right? The deadliest addiction, and it's not drugs. And then you might not think of that as pain, but it's a sort of little unsettled feeling that you have. And then you go, well, I want to make that feel better. I want the answer to that, no matter how you go about doing it, right? So when the pain network is activated, then we want pleasure. And this one, I practically quoted this just because they want to make sure you understand they're not just talking about like one person said this, but over 2 decades worth of studies from over 60 neuroscientists that are conducting brain scans show that when one feels aggrieved and one starts thinking about retaliating, I'm going to make them feel what I felt. They're going to feel the same kind of pain that they made me feel, right? Then the brain's pleasure and reward circuitry of addiction activates. So when you start thinking about revenge, it's all you got to do is start thinking about it. The parts of your brain that are about pleasure and about reward, the circuitry that's part of addiction, pain and pleasure and reward, and pain and pleasure and reward, it activates. So it's just like being on drugs. They said that the brain scans look the same. When you feel aggrieved and you start fantasizing about revenge. And then if you actually act on it, well, what do you expect? Maybe for a brief period of time, you feel satisfied and then you don't. And then you go through the whole thing again. Then you feel aggrieved. And then you get the fantasies and you get the craving to do this. Maybe you don't act on it. Maybe it's just enough to fantasize in it. Now, these scientists, here's where the article wanted to make sure that as far as the understanding of how revenge works, you know, that it was over the past 2 decades with over 60 neuroscientists. This next part is a little less observed because all they say is, quote, researchers, unquote. When you see something like that in an article, at least when I do, when they're bringing out the big guns in one hand and then on the other hand, then they just stop giving you numbers, you know, at least pay attention, because it probably means it's a lot less supported by multiple observations. But researchers using MIR scans have found that there's a way out of this, and it's forgiveness. And that's kind of a surprising one, but maybe it's not. So brain scans have shown that even imagining forgiveness against those who have wronged you deactivates your brain's pain network. And that's the thing that starts this whole thing out. So when you think that people have aggrieved you, there goes the pain network, and then we need the pleasure, and then blah, blah, blah. And we're back at pain and pleasure. And by the way, both those, dukkha, the pain, the pleasure, the pain, the pleasure. None of that stuff lasts. And it's the stuff that we go after all the time. We have to feel the pain, try to get the pleasure. The pleasure is, you know. So with forgiveness, just imagining forgiving somebody we think has wronged us, that deactivates our pain network. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. And if you've ever forgiven somebody in your mind, if you've ever felt like somebody has wronged you, and you actually let that go, which is hard to do, and now we know why, at least it seems to suggest there's some pleasure that comes from keeping that stuff alive, right? But if you can let that go, there's just a release that happens in it. It's a release. And that release, I guess, is the pain's not there anymore. And there's the release. So I started thinking about that word forgive. You know, I looked it up in two different dictionaries. I looked it up in the Merriam-Webster dictionary, just kind of my go-to, just sort of normal, everyday dictionary, right? And to forgive is to cease to feel resentment against an offender, to pardon, to give up resentment of or claim to requital for, to grant relief from payment of, right? So it's you're thinking they're gonna pay for what they did, right? It's to grant relief from that. It's to give up that demand. But I thought, I wonder if we can kind of round this out a little bit and look at some earlier usages of forgive. And so I went to that great dictionary, the Oxford English Dictionary, which if you ever see it physically, it's about, I don't know how many volumes it is, 20 volumes or something. It's pretty giant, right? And now we can, thanks to electronics, we can just access that thing, the whole thing, on the library. We are Hennepin County Library subscriber, those of you in the Twin Cities. Go to Oxford English Dictionary. It's pretty amazing. And so they have a couple of obsolete usages of this word that I thought really kind of helped me see what these researchers were seeing in their studies, right? And the first, to forgive, is to give or grant. To give. That's a little bit different than what we had before. It was give up. And this is to give or to grant. To grant what exactly? To give what? On the second obsolete definition, and both of these are definitions that stopped by the 16th century, so these are old definitions. To give up, to cease to harbor resentment or wrath. And I got caught by the word harbor because of one of our teachings about harboring ill will. Yeah. It's one of our precepts. When we're harboring ill will, we're not following the way, we're not on the path. So to give up, to cease to harbor resentment or wrath, also to give up one's resolve to do something. And those meanings really helped me to see, to give and to give up. And I saw in to give and to give up the same activity, right? To give up ourselves, to give up, to cease to harbor, right? That is to open ourselves up to just what is taking place, to give ourselves up to this. And that's our practice, to give ourselves up to this, to give that notion of me who's been wronged, to give that up to the situation, to give ourselves fully to this. That's our practice. That's what we're giving, you know, ourselves fully to this, to be this. And Zazen, we come back to our breath, which is right here. It's right now. It's no interpretation. It's no analysis. It's no explanation. It's just this. And getting back to place to practice, then this is what we do right here and right now. And in these difficult times where we're caught, what do we do? Well, right here it is. Right now it is. We know that. That's why we're coming back to this practice. That's why we're doing this, because we actually know that. Right here, right now. just giving ourselves up to this, being completely open to this, being this. So that is my talk. I don't know if people have comments or questions, observations. Yeah, Mary.
I don't have anything to say other than it feels good to hear you talk about the times and our perspective to all this. So thank you.
Yeah, it's hard to not, you know. I was at a record store yesterday, The Electric Fetus, which is probably one of the most oddly named record stores, but, you know, it came from the 60s, right? But anyhow, so, and I have a friend who's one of the clerks there at The Electric Fetus. We were talking a little bit about that. You know, I just asked him how he was doing, because as I was coming into the record store, there was a helicopter hovering right over. I mean, I could just see it, and it hovered there the whole time I was at the store. We were just talking about, you know, I mean, you just can't avoid this. So thanks. Yeah, it's unavoidable. So I will say, he did point out, and if you haven't heard this, at least brought me some joy in this. He said, did you hear about that white nationalist rally? And I said, I had. The one that only 12 people showed up to, and the protesters were able to just sort of shoo them away. I said it was the one bit of good news that I've heard in the last few days. So, any other observations or comments?
What was that? I heard about that, and then also another bit of good news. I wasn't able to go, but Kate was able to go, and it was just a singing event, which turned out to be 600 people marching down the street. I think it was kind of Powderhorn area, which I don't know. It's just kind of like, with everything going on, the mind can so easily go to, you know, what do I find I think is the most effective way? And then it sort of has that tinge of getting back at the other side or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And to know that these events are happening, where it's just giving, you know, being in this activity that's pretty neutral.
Yeah.
Has such a positive feeling to it. Sort of has just a embracing feel to it. And again,
Say they were singing?
Yeah, singing.
And anything in particular?
It was different songs. Yeah, I think it was kind of like folk songs, kind of shape note type of stuff. But and I think they were designing some of the songs around supporting different communities. So it was, some of the songs were catered to sort of the topics that were happening. Yeah. So there might have been some political kind of flavor to the, some of the songs. But
yeah, but the act of singing itself doesn't even matter, does it? Do you know what I mean? Like, something about singing. And I wish that I could sing. So usually when I sing, it's not in the presence of other people, or it's in the presence of my husband. And he never points out the key modulations that my songs will undergo as I'm singing my songs. But there's something about the act of singing. And there's just something joyous in it.
Yeah.
You know, and the more people there are, the easier it is for you to just sing. You know, so then you don't have to worry about 600 people. I'd be singing my guts out if there are 600 people there. Do you know what I mean? I was at a, I went to one of those Messiah sing-alongs once, you know, and I knew somebody had a score, so I had the score in front of me. And I was a music major. I could kind of read stuff, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I could kind of guess how it was supposed to go. But I also knew that because of my lack of control in my voice. But there was a room full of people singing, and it was handled. Do you know what I mean? This glorious music. And so singing seems like a wonderful, wonderful thing to do.
Yeah, she described some of the people coming out of their house and sort of the very moved look on their faces. And, pretty beautiful. So
yeah.
I'm not sure how it ties into your talk. It seems like it does somehow, but thought I'd mention it.
Well, there it's just engaging in that activity of singing, you know? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, Kaylee. From who?
From Mary Online.
Mary? Go ahead, Mary.
Thanks.
Hey, Steve. So, you know, I always think we live in a much more complicated world than, you
what
know,
kind of world?
Much more complicated world than, you know, compared to like the Buddhist time. So our food, our possessions, you know, the gas in our car, everything, we have no connection to really where it came from. We have no idea what happens to it when we're done. It just, we throw it away and it's just gone.
Yeah.
Does that change as far as what you were talking about, kind of seeing the bigger picture, and does that change kind of what we're trying to, what you're trying to accomplish, what's, you know, what the challenge there is? Does that change things or make a difference, or how do you kind of approach that?
It's the way it's always been, but you're okay. Right. You know, I think about, was it Uchiyama? I think it was Uchiyama was talking about how, you know, you can flip on a light switch now and you get light, and before you might want to needed to have, the way he put it was sort of like, he said, you'll need servants to bring the torches in, you know, but he was at least understanding the fact that, you know, the conveniences that we have now, as you're pointing out, bury what's going on. But our practice isn't to see all of the stuff. It's to be aware of the fact that everything that's showing up, innumerable labors, right? That you can't even, you know, imagine all of it has gone into this. If you could do that with everything, right? So thinking about, we'll say simpler times, or, you know, less complicated times, but times where maybe you had a closer relationship to the food you were eating and the clothes you were wearing, you still have the teaching of innumerable labors have brought us this food. You still have that carrot in front of you. You still have that rice in front of you. And it's the same situation. So as long as we live each moment and encounter each thing, understanding that what we're really encountering is the universe, you know, is all of reality. And it's just showing up as that. To me, there's something really remarkable, or I say remarkable. It's unremarkable in a way because you can't say anything about it. It's unremarkable in a way because it's every single moment of our life. And yet it's pretty amazing because it's right there in every moment of our life. So while I think that the stuff we have now maybe is really good at obscuring, you know, its connection, and really draws our attention to, I would say what a lot of it does is fosters desire in us, you know, just, it just makes it so easy for us to do stuff. But the practice of just realizing that whatever showing up, thought or constructed thing or organic thing, whatever it is, that it's not just the thing itself. It's, you know, it's all beings have come together for this experience of carrot, or this experience of my car is talking to me right now, you know, whatever that is. So I'm not sure it's really more of a challenge, only because we're talking about, you know, I mean, just with my hands, but infinitely small as well. We're talking about totality just showing up, and our tendency to get caught at the level of objects. And I think that's been there as long as humans get caught by objects. But you're right. As we're living these convenient lives, to just remind ourselves that there's more to it. You know, there's more showing up there than just that, whatever it is, that our explanation of what it is, what we're taking this to be, is inadequate, isn't the whole picture. So, it's a good question. Very good question. Mary is back. Hi, Mary. Mary, it appears we're experiencing technical difficulties right now.
How is this?
There we go.
What I was going to, is that sometimes people use forgiveness as a tool. In other words, if I forgive you, I expect you to change. And really, that's not the forgiveness is just for the person forgiving and not for the person who's been forgiven, because you can't expect someone to change just because you forgive them. They're going to do what they're going to do. But if you don't, I don't believe in a way in forgiveness. because it sets me above the other person. Like I have a right to tell them that I approve of you and I'm putting my stamp of approval on you as a person that's higher than you. And this just doesn't work for me. But if you really, like you say, take the whole in, you can show people a mirror of what they're doing without judging them. And if you're doing that, there's no separate Mary who's forgiving them and giving them absolution if they just want to keep doing what they're going to do anyway, you know? No. I don't feel like I've been hurt when someone hurts me because I'm not above them, but also to let everybody be free without interfering with other people. And this whole judgment and forgiveness, I up above you, forgive you, doesn't alter their experience if they don't care. And it doesn't help me because I'm not above them. So this is just a concept that I think creates perhaps an artificial division between people and sets one above another. And although if you feel at peace with just what is, then your brain will be accepting the whole. Because there was never a problem in the first place, really, unless you decide there was. And it's just what something, because I go through this every day. Anyway, I just thought I'd share that.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Mary. Yeah, you know, and at least from the way you were defining forgiveness as having that judgment in it, yeah, that sounds like it's potentially divisive, right? So I don't want to get into debate about, you know, the definition of forgiveness, but the way I was describing it was more along the lines of, you know, the idea of letting things be, you know. So what we realize we're doing is we're hanging on to, we're harboring ill will, and then we're giving that up. And we're giving that up by giving up our sense of that self that has been aggrieved, that has been under assault, right? So we're opening ourselves up to this. So if that's forgiveness, that seems to me it's in line with what you're talking about. But if you're talking about something else, yeah. You know, and like I said, I don't want to debate what people mean by forgiveness. I have a feeling there are different ways to talk about it. So just the way I'm talking about it, which is to notice when you're hanging on to and harboring ill will, when you're hanging on to pain, when you're seeing the world as being outside of you and aggrieving you, we do that, you know, it's a human thing. Well, our ego gets in there and we sort of, and you know, and it can range from serious to just kind of goofy, like clickbait. Do you know what I mean? But it's when we're pointing outwards and we're saying, because of that, I'm feeling like this. And if I'm feeling like this, maybe if I did that to let them, you know, once you, it's just to see you're doing that and to let that go, to give that up, to give yourself up to this moment. You're right. You're not, it's not to change anyone. That's not the point of it. The point of it is actually to see there really isn't anyone. You know, at least not in the way that we're putting it together there. So I appreciate those thoughts though, Mary. Thank you. Yeah. Denny, go ahead, Denny.
Oh, Danny, we're also muted.
All right, I got it. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
You know, in the beginning, I think you were saying with what's going on in Minnesota, we all try to, when there's a major event, sorry, this is kind of like a comment, but a question as well. We all try to think of what's the right view, maybe, or what's the right side, you know, pick a side. Would it be kind of like my analogy when I try to tie it into Buddhist teachings would be like the Kakina Goda Sutta, Sutra, if I'm saying that correctly, where they were asking the Buddha, what's the right view? And, you know, non-existence, don't take the extreme views, you know, not non-existence or existence. So I guess my question is, maybe a lot of us naturally with dualism or whatnot try to pick a side, you know, right, left, right. Do we have to pick a side? Just, you know, pick the middle way, right? I guess that's my question. Do you view it as an experienced practitioner? Do you try to view things in that way just in everyday life? Like, you don't have to take an extreme, just take the middle way. You don't have to be on the left. You don't have to be on the right. If you want to make it political in this example, do you, I guess that's my question. Would that help you in your opinion, I guess, to just always try to take the middle way?
Yeah. Well, thanks for that question, Denny. And that sutra, which Aaron had pointed out, you know, when they're talking about one seen with right wisdom, right? Is that what he says? You see the things as they have come to be. That's what he says. Things as they have come to be with right wisdom. We're talking about the middle way, but I would be, the one thing I'd be a little cautious about is thinking that there's a way that's the middle way, that's not the that way or the other way, because then it just becomes another way. So the middle way, what you can do is, as you are acting, you could see if you're clinging to any particular, I don't know, view, any particular extremity. What are you holding on to there? And then when you've done that, it's not that then you just throw what you're holding out the window necessarily, but now you've got some clarity on what's taking place. And I think this is important. So I had a question in a class once where somebody had noticed something that was kind of offensive in a text that we were reading, and he wanted to have a conversation about it. And I said, well, did you notice that your response to that offensive text was the conditions of right now showing up as your volatile response to that? Your, you know, and this person took that as a critique of their feeling that way. Where I was just saying, our structures of feeling are conditioned, just like everything else. You know, whatever it is that's showing up, it's conditioned, and it's conditioned. You can start kind of, like I said, everything is showing up in it. So I guess what I'm saying is what we can do is when we're acting or thinking or speaking, we can see what we might be hanging on to when we're acting, including, you know, a middle way. So the middle way is really just to live in a way that's not attached to views of the world, but it's not to have views. I don't know if that's helpful.
Very.
So the middle way isn't necessarily just like cutting the difference between this or that. You know, it's really about no matter what idea you're holding up, it's to see it for what it is and to not be attached to that if you can, you know, to realize what's showing up and not to attach. And that's the middle way, because to attach is to now ascribe meaning to it, right, or reality to it. It's to make it exist in the terms of the Kakaya Nagota Sutra.
So that was very helpful, because yeah. I like how you said you could grasp to the middle way.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, any idea that we have, we can grasp onto it very easily. So thanks for that question. That's really great. And in a moment like this, again, it's just sort of like, what do we do? And just, I'd say, keep that alive. That's really, that question is very helpful. What do we do? Well, what do we do? Thank you. We're almost at 11 here, so time for one more question or comment if anyone has anything. Aaron?
Right action's been on my mind recently. I was on the Eightfold Path class with you, Steve, and thinking of what I've heard from you and Steve, other teachers here about right action being what is appropriate to the moment, acting out of the whole, and just having a sense of awareness of in the midst of this action, what's going on, watching your own mind, watching your own inclinations, regardless of what you're doing, you know, whether you're going to feed a family, you know, being aware of what's coming up in the midst of that, and just right action as responding to what's appropriate, to what the situation needs, and not evaluating who you are in light of that, but just doing what needs to be done. And that's what's coming up. And for me, is connected to this seeing what's right here, or seeing the whole, and then acting in the whole, connected to the view of seeing the whole, but acting out of the whole as well. That there, it sounds like what you're saying is it's not this kind of passive posture of us having to arrive at the correct way of seeing the situation, but it goes into every aspect, dimension of our experience, and that is the experience of action, or the experience of meditation, or any one of those things. So that's what's kind of coming up for me, is what is appropriate, what does a moment need, and how do I respond to that?
Yeah, that's great. That's absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. All right, we're at 11 o'clock. So thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.